Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your humble host is grateful to the people who support this program. Let's name names. Robert Donjacour, James Balk, James Swift, Deborah Newell. They voluntarily subscribe to the Peter B. Collins Show, and if you're able and you'd like to, you can do it too. Just go to peterbcollins.com and look for the links on the right-hand side of the homepage. Our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. In the second portion of this podcast, we're going to meet Greg Mitchell. He blogs at thenation.com, and he's covering WikiLeaks, Bradley Manning, Julian Assange, and related issues. And toward the end, we will observe the bizarre development that Barack Obama has secretly received an award for excellence in transparency. Bradley Manning was not present for that event. But first, a husband and wife journalist team join me in the studio today, Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald. Their new book is called Crossing Zero. It's a must read about the war in Afghanistan and the question posed by this song. Why are we there?
Here we go again, asking, why are we there? Osama bin forgotten, seems he's nowhere. So many satellites up in the sky. He's either invisible or he probably died. Why are we there? It is fair to ask. How long will 9/11 justify the task? I grew up watching a war in Vietnam. I never understood why we were there dropping bombs. The Gulf of Tonkin put more troops in harm's way. Then we watched the caskets with numbers growing every day.
Musical credit to John Neems, N-I-E-M-S.
We should let them be.
Let them be.
And a warm welcome to Paul Fitzgerald and his wife, Liz Gould. Thanks for joining me here. You're in California on a book tour, and I'm really glad to have you on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Well, thank you for inviting us, Peter.
And we first met via Sibel Edmonds and the Boiling Frogs interview series, that's and right. I want to thank you as well for your contributions there. You have been covering Afghanistan going all the way back to the 1980s. Paul, tell us about your first visit there on a reporting journey.
It was a very unusual experience. I had a talk show in Boston for a few years, and Liz and I were doing a documentary on the arms race. It was the station that I was working at was airing a documentary called The Salt Syndrome, which was a documentary that was warning in no uncertain terms about the perils of negotiating with the Soviet Union. And so they were proposing a massive increase in defense spending. If not, then Soviet tanks would be rolling down Pennsylvania Avenue at any moment. So I went to the management and said, you really can't be airing this without countering it with some kind of public service announcement, some kind of public service documentary that with the alternative point of view. So why don't you let me go out and interview some of these people? So we went out and interviewed some. We interviewed Paul Warnke, who had negotiated the SALT II agreement, Strategic Arms Limitation Agreement, which was pending before Congress, and which Jimmy Carter and Leonid Brezhnev had signed that summer in 1979.
Right. And my cousin, who was a Navy admiral at the time, was on the negotiating team.
Is that right?
Eddie Welch.
Really?
He passed away about 3 years ago.
Wow. Well, it was a landmark treaty, and it came about not because the United States wanted to do it, but because of Vietnam. Paul Warnke told us in the interview that we did with him that that he and Robert McNamara had been to the Soviet Union, I believe, in 1968, and they were approached by a lot of mid-level bureaucrats who told them that, you know, this was the era of Yeltsin and Gorbachev. They were young men at that point, and they came to them and they said, we know the Soviet system is dying. We know it's running out of gas. We can't generate enough capital. We can't invest in what we need to invest in, and the arms race is killing us. Mm-hmm. So can we come to some kind of agreement here? And the fact is that the problem that they recognize, the fact is the problem is that they could not get out from under their own arms bureaucracy. They were overwhelmed by it. In fact, their own triumphalist narrative from World War II was still the prevailing wisdom in the Soviet Union, held by Gorbachev and Chernyenko and the entire Politburo, the higher echelons of the Politburo, who are now all in their late 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm. And instead of a corporate military-industrial complex, it was more of a communist military.
I like to describe the Soviet Union as effectively state capitalism versus corporate capitalism. Mm-hmm. That's actually, I think, the only difference.
Yeah.
And, of course, that was probably one of the reasons they got into such trouble economically, because they literally had no kind of overarching intervention in deciding that they could literally promote military expenditures to the complete exclusion at some fundamental level of the civilian economy.
Sure.
And that's what undid their economy.
And they had that series of five-year plans.
That's right.
And they were all built around the military first.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. So they were really suffering economically. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, because of Vietnam, the United States, the Congress, and the president were open to the idea that something had to give.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, all right, let's just lessen things for a while and let's see how they go. So that was in 1968, and the first round of strategic arms limitations talks was signed actually by President Nixon. I think it was 1972.
That's about right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so it proceeded from there. So the big question when Carter came in was how quickly they were going to rush through this second round of the strategic arms limitations and what they were going to prohibit. And of course, by then, the so-called military-industrial complex and the defense Democrats and the neoconservatives had all decided, they had all started recooking the old Cold War schema that had that had come up in 1947 and 1948. And so there was all this propaganda out there. And so
We also interviewed John Kenneth Galbraith as a part of this documentary. We wanted to really understand the economic implications of defense spending, and he was very clear about the fact that the United States had already hurt itself economically through the Vietnam expenditures, and we desperately needed to reinvest in the civilian economy. And this, again, this is right at the end of the 1970s when we're interviewing him. And so he was really talking from a position of, thank goodness it's happening. This is what we need. And when you look now and see the fact that we did not make that reinvestment then, you can begin to see that we're really living with the legacy of having not done it back then. But what happened in December 27, 1979, when the Soviet Union crossed the border into Afghanistan, it literally opened up the floodgate of all the neocon thinking and of all the defense Democrats and the idea of resurrecting a military economy basically equaling World War II suddenly became justifiable.
Mm-hmm. And it was a new front for the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. And you see, what most people were not aware of, and even today I bring up this subject and people are not aware of it, was the Team B. Now, the Team B was a group of neoconservatives and hawks and Scoop Jackson, the so-called defense Democrats, and a whole consortium of cold warriors who had kind of been discredited in many cases by their support for the Vietnam War. And they put together this team, which was a revolutionary idea, which was the Team B. The CIA and the Defense Department would be Team A, and they would come in with a group of independent analysts and analyze what they had decided, and with a different methodology.
Right.
Their methodology was that it wasn't what the Soviets had. It wasn't the kind of equipment they had, how many missiles. It was what they intended to use them for, and which was something that was essentially fortune-telling. But they were very persuasive in their argument. At first, their ideas were rejected. They were all branded as this kind of very ideological. It was an ideological analysis of the Soviet Union. It was not a tactical or strategic analysis in a military sense.
And Paul, you'll be comforted to know that the Team B reference came up in a recent book that I read, and I interviewed the author, William Hartung. His book, Prophets of War, about Lockheed Martin, he talks about how the Team B concept was used by the Project for a New American Century, the PNAC group, in the late 90s, to build an appetite for an invasion of Iraq.
Yes, exactly.
And so that process been used to...
Failure doesn't matter to them.
Right.
They cut
profit.
They cut their teeth on this Team B assessment.
And 76.
Basically, if you read the Team B assessment, there's a redacted version that's available you can get online. And it essentially says that the Soviets are going to be making a move towards the Persian Gulf. There was another report that was done by the CIA around the same time that stated that the Soviet Union was running out of oil. Of course, we know today the Soviet Union, I believe, is the world's largest oil producer, or at least second largest oil producer next to Saudi Arabia. And it wasn't a fabrication. It was just a lousy report that they did. It was bad analysis. The Soviets were having some problems getting oil out of the ground, but they still had plenty of oil. And so anyway, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, of course, after 2 years of provocation by the United States, which has been admitted to by Zbigniew Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor,
right.
was also admitted to by Robert Gates, who is now the Secretary of Defense, in his own book, From the Shadows. He says that they were funding Mujahideen rebels in the 1979, early on 1979, in order to provoke something in this, provoke a Soviet attack.
And Gates was part of the same process at the CIA in the early 1980s when he was feeding the Reagan White House the information they wanted to build up the threat of the Soviet Union in order to slay that beast. We're talking with Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould. Their new book, Crossing Zero, is subtitled The AFPAC War at the Turning Point of American Empire. Now, I brought out my 1994 Rand McNally World Atlas, and I have photographed you, Paul, pointing to the Durand Line, which is also called the Zero Line, the source of the title for your book. We'll post the pictures so people can get an idea of what you were pointing at. But tell us about the Durand Line and why it is significant in the shifting fortunes of the nation of Afghanistan.
Well, it is the single largest factor in terms of Afghanistan's problem with Pakistan and the creation of Pakistan. You have to go back to the 19th century and the two Anglo-Afghan wars that were fought, 1839 to 1842, 1879, same thing again. There was a debate in the British Parliament between what were known as the forward policy people, the Tories, who wanted to push over the Hindu Kush into Afghanistan, divvy it up into sections. They had been doing that all through India for centuries at that point, taking province by province, moving northeastward. And as the Russians moved southward, they were doing the similar kind of thing in the southern republics, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, what are today Turkmenistan, and Kazakhstan. And so by 1893, the British and the Russians had pretty much come to a stalemate. They didn't really want to go to war with each other. So they pretty much decided that they would use Afghanistan as a buffer between the two. But the liberals insisted in Britain, in the British Parliament, that the end of the British Empire was the Indus River. Now, if you look at a map, is a whole chunk of what today is Pakistan that used to be Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
It also had a connection to Baluchistan and access to the Arabian Sea. It was a very valuable piece of property. If you seize that, and you seize it all the way, and you seize Iranian territory as well, which was what was going on in the 19th century, then you leave Afghanistan landlocked, without trade routes, and completely dependent on the British Empire to get their produce to market. The largely rural economy, a land-based economy, they needed those trade routes over the Hindu Kush to the Arabian Sea to sell their produce into India.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the creation of Pakistan in 1947, of course, even exacerbated the issue. But in 1893, Britain's foreign secretary for India drew a line down the middle of the Hindu Kush and said, all right, look it. We'll administer all the territories on our side of the border, and you, the Emir of Afghanistan, Abdurrahman, will administer everything on the other side, on the western side of this line. Now, the Afghans always insisted that this was just a temporary border. There's a lot of scholarship to indicate that it really was and only intended to be an administrative line,
mm-hmm.
not a permanent boundary. And so as a result of that, and similar to the kind of agreement that Britain had with China over Hong Kong, as an example, which they have returned to Hong Kong, the lease, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was, of course, when the Afghan emirs would go to the British and say, we'd like to renegotiate the line, the Durand line, they would say, oh, don't worry about that. We're not going to be here forever. Whenever we leave the area, we'll renegotiate it then.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 1947 comes along, and they say, we're leaving the area. So the Afghans say, all right, let's renegotiate the line. And say, oh, no, we're leaving. We have nothing to do with it any longer. This is up to the Pakistanis to do that. Creation of the State of Pakistan, 1947. So there was a lot of difficulty. The tribes, the Pashtun tribes, there were more Pashtuns in what was to be Pakistan than there were in Afghanistan. But the Afghan leadership, the royal family, insisted that this be brought before the United Nations and voted upon. There were a lot of the way in which the tribes on both sides of the border were allowed to vote as to whether they should join with their tribes in the east really was all, it was pretty much jerry-rigged. It was a jerry-rigged election. And so as a result of that, these tribes wound up having to accept, once again, the Durand Line. And once the Cold War, Pakistan signed on with the United States as a Cold War ally. And once that happened, any time the Afghans would protest the line, Pakistan would shut the border, get on the phone to Washington and say, those Afghans are causing trouble for us. They must be doing something with the Russians, must be causing this. The Soviets must be in there agitating. You have to give us more aid. You have to give us more income. You have to help us more. So this went on.
So Musharraf wasn't the first.
It's really fascinating. When you look at that, you can read all of these cables now. They're all declassified from the 1950s and 60s and 70s. And every time anything happened in Afghanistan, the Pakistanis would immediately run to the American embassy and say, you know, you have to give us more money because the Afghans are inspiring mm-hmm. insurrections in Baluchistan or insurrections in the Punjab or wherever.
Now, Liz, one other aspect of this history of the last 100 years or so, and there's much more to it that you do reference in the book, but in 1919, the Emir declared independence from Britain, and there was a brief war that led to the Treaty of Rawalpindi. Tell us about that episode and how it suggests whether or not Afghanistan has the makings of a civil society and potentially a democracy, which is what Americans are often told.
Well, King Amanullah actually, when he declared basically independence for Afghanistan and eventually did win that independence, Afghanistan still was really, its foreign policy was still completely controlled by the British, but it did allow them a unique experience in the region. And one of the things that's particularly impressive is what Amanullah did with that opportunity. He created the first constitution. He gave women the right to vote. So there were many other issues that were included in this constitution that actually prove, in no question, that the Afghans really did want to formally embrace democracy. They wanted to formally recognize the idea of individual human rights. Of the fact that women were given the right to vote in 1923, I think, speaks for itself. Afghan women did not have to actually ask for that right. It was given to them. And I think your audience should realize that I believe Swiss women didn't get the right to vote until something like 1972 or three, something like that. So that I think we need to recognize that this idea that somehow Afghans are not ready to embrace modernity, the truth is that the British Empire actually was far more responsible for slowing down a lot of the efforts of King Amanullah. I think that it was Lawrence of Arabia, I think, was one of the people who was brought in to actually try to convince some of the tribes that they could actually get better results by going with the British and trying to stir trouble for Amanullah. So you can see that there was manipulation, and it was clearly getting in the middle of the tribal, the tribal relations, and making it difficult. And also the economic strangulation that the British Empire had on Afghanistan made it very difficult for Amanullah and future monarchies to actually support all of this progress. When you educate people, you have to have an economy that can support that education. But the idea that the people of Afghanistan rejected Amanullah and future advances is absolutely not true. It really had more to do with the economic strangulation and the fact that the British Empire actually did not want to have a visible Islamic country showing a modern, progressive nature as Afghanistan
that
was.
That it would be successful.
Yeah.
This was even stated by an expert, an American expert, Leon Paluta, wrote a book about it, he stated that what Liz just said, his conclusion was that the British did not want a shining example of how a Muslim country could rise up from the dust and create its own independence and have a democracy and an educated middle class. And what's interesting is that the programs that these people did initiate in the 1920s did by the 1970s, the educational system was graduating 20,000 secondary school students a year by the mid-1970s. And I have this quote, which is interesting, this is from Charles Dunbar. It's a quote from a document that was in 1970. Charles Dunbar was the political officer in the Kabul embassy for the United States in the late 1960s, early 1970s. He was the chargé d'affaires when we were there in 1983, when we brought Roger Fisher. He was running the embassy, and he moderated an event that we did when our first book came out, and he's now a professor at Boston University. So we've run across Charlie Dunbar on a few occasions, and he knows Afghanistan very well. And this is a quote that he made in his end-of-tour comments in August of 1970. In the first place, during the 7 years of the experiment, this was the experiment in democracy, Afghans have become acutely conscious and indeed jealous of the personal freedoms guaranteed them under the 1964 Constitution. This consciousness has manifested itself in hitherto undreamed-of criticism of the government by members of Parliament, students, and the free press. This criticism has done much to shape the course of events since 1963. Many educated Afghans carry the Constitution in their back pockets and quote from it extensively, and it is clear that, however much they may criticize the experiment as a royally inspired charade, they have developed some faith in the document as a guardian of their rights. This was in 1970. He goes on later in that particular document and says, whatever happens in this country, he said, there is absolutely no way that this kind of attitude on behalf of the Afghan people, now that they have tasted the fruits of democracy, can be taken away.
There's also another series of events that occurred that I think support the fact that the Afghan people were very eager to embrace this process and legitimize it and formalize it. Amanullah, of course, the first constitution in 1923, but the 1964 constitution restated the people of Afghanistan without any discrimination or preferences have equal rights and obligations under the law. The Article 26, liberty is the natural right of the human being. The liberty and dignity of the human being are inviolable and inalienable. The Constitution of 1976 clarified the issue of women's rights in Article 27 by stating that all people of Afghanistan, both men and women, they went to the trouble to make it clear that women had equal rights under the law, without discrimination and privilege, have equal rights and obligations under the law. And this is even more interesting, that the Constitution of 1987, enacted under the Communist Party rule, went even further. Huh. They took the trouble of actually not only both men and women have equal rights, but irrespective of their national, racial, linguistic, tribal, educational, social status, religious creed, political conviction, occupation, wealth, and residence.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty
specific.
Pretty global.
Comprehensive.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Now, let's talk about the Soviet occupation in the 1980s, the U.S. funding for the Mujahideen, and the term that Chalmers Johnson developed called blowback. Paul, you want to start with that?
When we were there in 1981, we saw that the biggest problem that the Afghans were having was not from the Soviets. The biggest problem that the Afghans were having were these terrorists coming over the mountains from Pakistan, burning down schools, mainly for women, but not just for women. They were trying to prevent the modernization process from occurring in Afghanistan, and toppling power stations, blowing up bakeries, blowing up flour mills, things like that. That was a fairly common thing that they were doing. The Afghans, even this, the spokesman for the foreign ministry actually said to me at one point, he said, "Why is the United States doing this to us? It doesn't make any sense. You know, you're not a colonial power. Britain and Russia are colonial powers. You know, we called on the Russians to come down here and help us stop this sort of thing. It was going on before they came in force, you know. And so please go back to the United States and tell the government that we'd rather have a strong relationship with the United States than we would with Russia." So this was what was going on in 1981. And I interviewed the Barbara Karmal, the person who had been installed by the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. which, of course, in the Western media, he was presented as being the Soviet puppet who had been installed. What's right. interesting is that Barbara Karmal had a long history of political involvement as a leftist, as a parshamist. The PDPA, the Marxist Party, was divided into two sections. One was called Parsham, the other was called the Kalk. The Kalk were more Maoist in their orientation, and they're the ones that had pulled off the coup in 1978 that overthrew the royal family, Mohammed Daoud. And so as a result of that, Barbara Karmal sat there and I asked him, what would it take to get the Soviets to leave? And he said, as soon as the United States, China, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia stop funding these terrorists coming over the mountains, then the Soviets will leave. The troops of the Soviet Union will go home. He said, until that happens, they're going to have to stay here. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we came home and we did our documentary, Afghanistan Between Three Worlds. It aired around the country on PBS. And at that point, we gave a demonstration. We gave early on in December of 1981. We gave a presentation of the documentary in Boston at the Parker House, the hotel in Boston, and the local media was invited. And also Ted Elliott, who was the dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, which teaches American diplomats, and he had been a former ambassador to Afghanistan, was there. Mm-hmm. What we didn't know at the time, he was also at that moment from 1979 to 1992, was also the General Secretary of the Bilderberger Organization.
Oh.
Well, when I presented my documentary and picture of what was really going on in Afghanistan, that the Soviets, I had no pictures of Russians bayoneting pregnant women, as alleged in Charlie Wilson's War, mm-hmm. or butterfly bombs. I had pictures of daycares and nursery schools and
well, not
women.
The Soviets were not even in sight. This was all Afghans.
The Soviets were keeping very low profile. Mm-hmm. We wanted to know what the Afghans were actually doing. We didn't really. We knew what the Western media thought of the Russians. We wanted to take it out from under this veil of Cold War confrontation. He took one look at this documentary and the pictures that we were showing, and he stood up, all 6 foot 7 feet of him, and said, "Who gave you permission to take those pictures? Who gave you permission to go to Afghanistan and say these things?"
He in public.
Wow.
And I said, this is in front of the Time magazine correspondent, in front of a number of Boston Globe people, and I said, "I didn't realize as an American citizen that I needed permission to go to Afghanistan. It's not a restricted country. It's not like Cuba. Mm-hmm. There's no restrictions on travel to Afghanistan. It's just dangerous, that's all. You're not restricting it at the State Department. So someone would ask a question from the audience, and instead of allowing me to answer the question from my experience, this gentleman would stand up and he would answer it for them, giving the official line that the Soviets were in Afghanistan to take our oil in the Persian Gulf and that we had to do everything in our power to stop them.
Wow. That's quite a story, Paul.
It was quite a scene, actually. I finally had to say to the ambassador, I said, you know, there was a time in the end. Oh, he finally said to me, he said, you know, I'm going to warn you, you're treading very closely to being a conduit for Soviet propaganda.
Mm.
And I said,
was Senator McCarthy around?
That's what I asked him. You tell the story, Liz.
Well, after Ambassador Elliott made that statement, Paul finally decided he had to do something. And he said, there was a time in this country, it was called the McCarthy era, mm-hmm. and it was a very dark time, and we're not going back there. And the audience stood up and applauded because everybody was in total shock that here we had not only an ambassador, here we had a man who was teaching our ambassadors, teaching the diplomatic community, and it was very undiplomatic, you know, in terms of what he had actually taken on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very obvious then that we had come up against the very edge of a very secret approach to the whole story. And clearly, you know, that's part of what the narrative that had been set by Dan Rather and CBS News about the holy warriors against the freedom fighters, and that was the story being maintained. We literally butted up against that.
Mm-hmm.
And Elliott made it very clear that that was really not to be touched.
Yeah. That narrative was not to be interfered with.
And let me ask you, because I did not follow these issues as closely as you did at the time. Your book has helped refresh some of my recollection. But I want to pin the tail on Zbigniew Brzezinski. And I saw him last week. He was on the NewsHour opposite Brent Scowcroft. Mm-hmm. And the two of them were debating their minor differences on the current military adventure in Libya. And it just reminded me of Brzezinski's history. So take a moment here, and without my bias, just explain to what extent you would say that the architect of our failed policy in the 1980s in Afghanistan was Brzezinski.
Well, I'd say that Brzezinski was clearly the motivator behind the idea of drawing the Soviets into the Afghan trap. And he certainly instrumentalized this process through the national security agencies. He was, you know, he was Carter's national security advisor.
Right.
And I believe he actually wrestled a part of the...
He wrestled control of the covert action arm of the CIA away from Cyrus Vance at the State Department.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened in the summer of 1978. So he had the ability to basically issue orders for covert operations in that part of the world without the interference of the diplomats. And
mm-hmm.
and this is something that we found, and we also found it to be very disturbing, was that there was a really violent feud going on between the State Department and the National Security Council. Brzezinski was taking the country one way, and Cyrus Vance wanted to take foreign policy the other way. In fact, when we talked to Paul Warnke, we last spoke with him. He's since passed away. But in 1993, we interviewed him, and he said, listen to Carter's speeches. He said, look at the speeches. He said, one sentence, he's speaking from Cyrus Vance point of view.
And he said, which was linking foreign policy to human rights, which was something that I applauded.
Right. And he said in the next breath, he said he's echoing Zbigniew Brzezinski. So he said Carter is definitely torn right down the middle. Cyrus Vance eventually resigned over, I think it was the Iranian hostage rescue. That was it. But that was just the last in a long string of frustrations for Vance.
Yeah.
Well, it all centered around the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty and the fact that Vance and that Carter himself had actually gotten elected advancing that idea.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really where Brzezinski was playing a critical role. And it was clear that the Team B report actually that had already prophesied that there was going to be a move on the part of the Soviet Union into a neighboring country on its way to the Persian Gulf, literally suddenly became active. And Brzezinski, it was as if Brzezinski was actually carrying out that prophecy. He was the one making it happen. And so when he boasted that he got Carter to sign the directive at least 6 months prior to the Soviet invasion, which authorized the the activity that he was actually carrying out against this. He was actually trying to foment revolution in the southern republics of the Soviet Union, and he was destabilizing the Soviet Union and then actually tricking them to try to come into Afghanistan, and the goal was to create Russia's Vietnam.
Right.
So these became the motivations, and once the Soviets crossed the border, it was as if the entire narrative just took off.
Mm-hmm.
It had already been written. And within 24 hours.
But that's
hours.
What's so interesting about the whole issue is that, and why you really can't get anywhere with this policy issue in Washington, is because the initial effort in Afghanistan was to get the Russians back for America's mistake of committing itself to Vietnam. So we were building a policy based on a mistake that we made in getting back at them for a mistake that they made.
Mm-hmm.
So there really never really was a reason for being there except, it was reactive. It was a reaction on a reaction. So it was
right.
a contradiction to a contradiction.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so today, and this is part of what we've been trying to get the story out, is that this kind of so-called triumphalist narrative that is now, since, well, the Soviets were defeated and Charlie Wilson ran the budget up from $5 million to a few billion dollars, and boy, we beat the Soviets in Afghanistan. We really tucked them in there. And the whole objective, of course, was to hold them there. It wasn't to throw them out of Afghanistan. The objective was to keep them there. So, but they claimed at the same time, part of the narrative was that all this money was being spent, and all these crazy things were being done to drive them out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so this is a fundamental contradiction. So our own people now, the younger and next generation, no institutional memory. They go into Afghanistan. They have no memory of what we just talked about
right.
the progressive democratization, the democratic history of Afghanistan. And so they go in there, and they're basically thinking that they're still fighting Charlie Wilson's war.
Mm-hmm.
And, except this time they're fighting against the people that they supported the last time. So there are so many twists and turns. This is a train wreck in slow motion as far as we're concerned, and we've been watching it happen since 1979.
But there's also, I think, the issue you mentioned earlier about the issue of blowback and how you can actually track the blowback. It's very interesting to watch the history of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. He is probably the perfect example of this idea of the blowback process.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 1970s, he ended up actually being sponsored by the Pakistani intelligence. Part of the financing that the United States actually became involved in early on was actually supporting Hekmatyar and Ahmad Shah Massoud to basically start the process of destabilizing Afghanistan. So this was actually 5 years before the Marxist coup. So you can see that the process that they were engaging, they might have used as an excuse the idea that the Marxists were the problem. Well, it turned out that Daoud in an earlier incarnation was the problem. So as you go through the years, you can see the process of Hekmatyar gaining a lot of support. Now we jump up to the 80s when Charlie Wilson is getting his budget going. And he is informed by Afghans working with the United States that the one person they definitely should not give any money to because he's dangerous to Afghanistan is Gulbuddin Hekmatyar.
Right.
Charlie Wilson completely disregards this concern of the Afghans, and he follows President Zia, who was the president of Pakistan, who, and of course the Pakistanis had been working with Gulbuddin. It was as if, you know, he really represented Pakistani interests. Gulbuddin got the money. He apparently, I think, received something in the range of 65% of the resources that went into through Pakistan, Gulbuddin received. And when the Soviets withdrew in 1989, it was Gulbuddin and Ahmad Shah Massoud who began the civil war. And it's interesting. I love when they call that a civil war. This was not a civil war. This was really the supposed Mujahideen holy war turned into basically sponsors of taking over Afghanistan and warring with each other to see who would claim the booty of Afghanistan. They destroyed 75% of Kabul in this battle. They killed something, the guess is, you know, their estimates of something like 50,000 Afghans were slaughtered in this battle. And ultimately, the creation of the Taliban itself was a direct result of the fact that Gulbuddin, who was the choice for the Pakistanis, could not actually control Afghanistan. So when you're looking at this process going along and you see how the financing of the Mujahideen and who were, of course, holy warriors back then. Suddenly now, we have to come up to date now, and we see the crisis that eventually became called Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
These are the kinds of people that eventually became the database known as Al-Qaeda. So this is all linked to the uncontrollable warlords, the drug running, the inability to bring stability and civil society back is all blamed on these processes. So these are all an outgrowth of the choices that the United States made in choosing to finance this. Basically, what I like to remind people is that these were criminals. The fact that they happened to be Muslim is secondary. We don't think of the Italian mob or the Korean mob in terms of their religious affiliations. We think of them as criminals.
Well, but if we had sent Sam Giancana and his boys to Afghanistan, they would have stood out a little bit. I'm sure it was considered.
Right.
Liz Gould and Paul Fitzgerald with us. Their new book is Crossing Zero. And Liz, we could spend more time in the 1980s, but you just gave me the perfect transition, because I think one of the reasons I will recommend your book to my listeners is that you explain the origins of the Taliban and the array of armed groups in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, in that porous border area, that we are arrayed against at this particular time. And our lazy corporate media lumps them all together as just the Taliban. Occasionally, a smarter-than-average reporter or columnist will make a distinction between the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistani Taliban. But I'd like you to take a couple of minutes here to describe the origins of the Taliban. Really, it was concocted at the ISI, the CIA equivalent in Pakistan, in the early 1990s. Who wants to start there?
This was a creation, as Liz mentioned. The Taliban was a creation of the Pakistani ISI, and according to the president of Pakistan in an interview in the United States just last year, the CIA as well. The CIA had a hand in that. There's also indications that that England and Pakistan were together in recruiting members of the old PDPA and the King's supporters for the Taliban. A general wrote. There's a lot of stuff that was available before 9/11 that's been kind of hushed up or just not talked about since then. But Sir Nicholas Barrington, who was the ambassador from England to Pakistan, the Royal High Commissioner, Pakistan is still a Commonwealth nation. It wasn't for a while, went back to being a Commonwealth nation, was said to be a recruiter, was helping recruit these people to join the Taliban in the mid-1990s. So, once again, we have a lot of different intelligence services involved in the creation of these people. The mythology is that this was an indigenous operation that grew up out of Kandahar, and therefore is, they're religious extremists, but they're all Afghans. Well, the fact is that they weren't all Afghans. These were Afghans, in some cases, who were raised in camps, refugee camps inside Pakistan, educated by Pakistani mullahs who had been trained in the Middle East with a very different kind of religious orientation that was traditional to Afghanistan. The boys themselves had no idea what Afghanistan's culture was really all about. They were really the only way to get an education was to go to these madrasas. They were free. If you wanted to be educated in a secular school, well, that was a different story. There simply weren't any, or you had to pay to be educated in a secular school. Refugees had no money, so they were basically prey to this sort of thing. Within a short period of time, when the Afghan Taliban started moving into Afghanistan at the behest of the ISI, Pakistan's intelligence agency, they were joined by Pakistani ISI agents. They were joined by Pakistani military who would simply resign their commissions, put on the black turban, and go to war with them. They were supported by Pakistani artillery, Pakistani tanks. This was not being reported at the time. There were only a couple of journalists who actually took the time to get involved in there and actually to see what they were doing. They were warmly received at first because the warlord culture had taken over. The Hekmatyar's people, all the different groups, the fractious groups of the Peshawar Seven that had fought the war against the Soviets were now ravaging the countryside, had become brutal warlords, And so when the Taliban marched into Kandahar, the people simply with waving flags of the representing the king and pictures of the king, the people just simply put down their guns and said, finally, someone has come to stop this rapacious behavior of the warlords. It wasn't really until the Taliban got into the areas of the other ethnic areas, the Tajik and Uzbek areas of the country, that the atrocities started to show up. And people really began to ask questions about who these people really were and what their objectives were. When the United States finally pushed them out, there had been negotiations going on with American oil companies over building pipelines across the northern part of Afghanistan. That seemed to be the major impetus during the Clinton administration, was a financial impetus. Yeah, there really was very little diplomacy going on at all. In fact, you know, people tend to look at the Republican administrations as being the era in which privatization occurred. Clinton administration advanced that pretty significantly, especially when it came to oil pipelines in Pakistan. So what we have is a situation now in which there's a broad brush applied to the term Taliban. The Afghan Taliban break down pretty much into three separate groups. Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's group, which is the Hezbi Islami, are labeled as Taliban. They really aren't Taliban, but they're one of the groups that are fighting Western forces, fighting NATO and the United States. Another group is the Haqqani Network. They were aligned with the United States back in the 1990s. They're considered to be the best fighters in the mix. They live in the Waziristan section of Pakistan, but they come over the border and they have lots of relatives on the Afghan side of the Durand Line. And the third group is the Kida Shura, which is Muhammad Ollah, Mullah Muhammad or Omar, who is supposed to be the supreme leader of all of these Taliban groups. Our conversations with people who should know about this have pretty much said that these groups are being labeled, a lot of these groups that are fighting the American forces are being labeled as Taliban when they're really not.
Yeah.
The Afghan government is extremely corrupt. They're going into these villages. They're basically the Afghan National Army, once again, another issue in this, a very important issue, which is mainly a Tajik-Uzbek army, which is being supported, the old Northern Alliance crowd, which is being supported actively by the United States as part of our policy, is openly antagonistic towards the Pashtuns. And there are very few Pashtuns of any authority who are part of this Afghan National Army. So the United States policy is really kind of building this thing up. It's setting it up so that when we do withdraw, when the United States does withdraw its forces, we're leaving it open to a civil war.
And we will have armed many of the factions.
Oh, armed and trained, of course. Armed and trained.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, you know, Stansfield Turner said, when he was asked, Stansfield Turner said that about the weapons that were supplied to the Mujahideen originally in the 1980s, he said that, well, if 20% of the weapons that were supplied actually got to where they were going, that was okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine what's going on right now. I mean, we talked with a soldier who was over there who said that, you know, one day some guy shows up and he gives him the training, and he said the next day his brother shows up with the same uniform on, claiming that he was his brother.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is the kind of thing that's going on in Afghanistan,
yeah.
You know. And then sooner or later, by the end of the week, there'll be no brother at all. There'll be nobody at all.
Now, Liz, again, to come back to these different groups that are lumped together as Taliban in the American media, on the Pakistani side, there is a loosely described Taliban, but there's also Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is alleged to be the group responsible for the Mumbai activities. Tell us a little bit about Lashkar.
Well, these are actually individuals who were being used by the Pakistani military to basically foment, a crisis with India. And that really is the obsession of Pakistan. That's one of the problems, that so much of the decision-making of the Pakistani military, and you have to really refer to their government as the military, because that's really the ones running the show.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been the case since the creation of the state of Pakistan. And you also have now, though, breakdowns that are even getting further and further problematic for the Pakistanis. As we know, the idea that I think you have to view the Taliban not just as a group of people, but as an idea. Okay, and there are many different representations. It has now spread like a disease. Some of it ends up in Afghanistan, and some of it is carried out now by Afghans. But in terms of the power base, I think that's what the really important thing. The power for this entity known as the Taliban really resides with the Pakistani ISI. In
Indeed.
Fact, Charles Cogan, who was the Directorate of Operations
Chief
of. You state what he is.
Chief of the Directorate of Operations for the Central Intelligence Agency from 1979 to 1984.
Yeah. Okay, right. Okay. He was running the show for the region. He actually has gone on record and said the Taliban is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Pakistani intelligence.
Now, in another part of the book, you make the very clear statement that we're being played by the Pakistanis. And that we have given them somewhere north of $5 billion to combat the Taliban and to bring us the heads of the leaders of Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And they take the money, and some of it appears to go directly to those enemy groups, and others gets absorbed in Musharraf's pocket and his expensive lifestyle in London now. But the bottom line is that we are not blind, deaf, and dumb. Yet we are being robbed from every pocket in broad daylight by people we claim are our allies.
Well that's almost because they call them daydream believers, okay? The people who are administering this policy. You know, there was an old joke about the Soviet Union was that they pretended to pay their workers with real money and they pretended to do work for it. Well, we pretend, we give the Pakistanis money to... we pretend to support the Pakistanis, and they pretend to give us a fight against the Taliban in return. It's all kind of it's the narrative. And to challenge the narrative, the system, there's so many people who've bought into this at an institutional level that it's impossible for them to get out of it. And this is, of course, as I said before, this is what we've been dealing with. This is that it's blinded them to the reality of the situation. We've heard commentary from a lot of very disgruntled foreign policy staff, from even CIA staff, about what's going on here. They know. The operational level people know what's going on. We quote from a number of different people, intelligence sources, chief of intelligence for the NATO group stated in a dossier a couple of years ago. He said, our people are might as well be fortune telling. He said he says, I don't want to say we're clueless, but we are. When it comes to these sorts of things, we're accepting Pakistan as an ally just simply at face value, regardless of the fact that there's very little evidence whatsoever that they're actually working on our behalf. In many cases, they're actually supporting Taliban groups that are firing on American soldiers, that are firing on American helicopters, that are firing on NATO forces, and it's very well known.
And it appears that the only benefit, and I'm holding up my fingers in air quotes here, that we get is that we have no treaty obligation, we have no authorization from the nation of Pakistan, we have no authorization from the United Nations to engage in warlike activities across the border in Pakistan. Yet we know there have been cross-border raids by helicopter and ground forces. We know that the Predator drones and other drones, there are different names of them, that we're flying them almost daily now, five times a week. Over Pakistan, the number of sorties escalated sharply since President Obama took office. And we are executing people on the ground based on the information we get from Pakistani intelligence. Mm-hmm. So we're participating in settling scores inside of Pakistan and actually creating more blowback because we don't really know the targets that we are honing in on and having some success in blasting. And I keep thinking of that female student who stood up to Secretary of State Clinton a year and a half ago when she visited Pakistan and said, how is this any different from terrorism? Mm-hmm. You are summarily executing people without charge or trial. And what we're discussing here is that we're doing so based on information that lacks credibility that comes from our alleged ally.
Well, I think that this is a story that's very emblematic of the oddness of what is going on between the United States and Pakistan. When the Taliban were being driven out of Afghanistan after the U.S. invasion, there was an event that occurred when it became obvious the Taliban were really going to completely withdraw because they were losing. It was called the Airlift of Evil. The airlift of evil was a phrase coined by American military personnel who were basically told to stand down as they witnessed the Pakistani Air Force and others removing al-Qaeda and Taliban from Afghanistan and bringing them back to Pakistan, and they were basically told not to interfere. That had to come from the highest levels. This is something that, so once again, I think that we're seeing that something doesn't add up, and it's obvious that we're not being told something fundamental.
We got our own little airlift of evil in Boston on the evening of 9/11 when a plane was allowed to land. You couldn't fly a plane anywhere in the United States, but a plane was allowed to land and take out all the members of the Bin Laden family who were living in the Boston area, whose children were attending schools in the Boston area, get on the plane and go away. And of course, it was later stated that these people were no security risk. The FBI deemed that they had been no security risk and therefore were allowed to go. But how that was determined in a matter of a few hours when the entire country was in a state of chaos and panic is hard to imagine.
Well, and that's not the only lingering question from the events of 9/11, and we'll have to save that for another day. In the interest of time, I want to fast forward, and I think what we need to do is schedule a follow-up phone interview, because in the middle of this is the last 9.5 years of America's invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, and I'd like to probably do another show to focus just on that. Mm-hmm. But I want to fast forward to where we are today, to President Obama's war in Afghanistan. And I just like to ask your thoughts, is there any way that we can prevail, even if we fudge the description of what prevail means, in a way that makes all this worthwhile? Because as I look at this, it's a complete dead end. It's so far the biggest blunder, and maybe Libya will, in future years, we'll look back and say Libya was even a bigger blunder. But from the current perspective, I think Obama's escalation of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan is his biggest foreign policy mistake. And I'd just like to ask, do you see any light at the end of any proverbial tunnel here? Paul first?
I think the biggest thing, the only thing at this point that is left for the United States to do, that it has the power to do, is to help some moderate Afghan politicians, give them security, give them the backing, give them the kind of backing that the United States gave to Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. Instead of backing right-wing Islamic extremists or corrupt warlords, which has been going on for the last 10 years, the United States should be supporting those Afghans in the diaspora, those 100,000 or so middle-class Afghans, educated Afghans still inside Afghanistan, who can be a part of the government but who have been ignored and who have been pushed out and who have been threatened by the likes of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and the warlords. We've been told that President Hamid Karzai himself probably isn't a corrupt individual, but he is surrounded. He has no power and is completely surrounded for any decision-making by some very, very bad people. So the United States does have the ability to make changes in that. It does have the ability to help establish a new loya jirga, whereby a legitimate tribal leader could emerge that would unify Afghanistan, that would prevent the civil war from evolving, and that would bring the country together in a more peaceful basis, and that a guarantee can be extracted by the United States from the neighboring countries. That would require, of course, coming to grips with the issues of Iran, getting Iran to sign on to, they helped the United States, in 2001. Mm-hmm. Iran was an ally. They thought they were going to get a reward for that. Of course, they haven't. And China, India, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia sign an agreement, non-interference, go back to a kind of limited neutrality for Afghanistan, enforce it, and get the neighboring countries to agree to that. Those are things that still can be done, but there has to be a will to do it, and there has to be the clarity of thought to do it, and not the conflicting agendas that seem to be absolutely hamstringing the Obama administration from being effective.
Now, Paul, just to be gentle about this, you didn't quite answer my question. You did recite some of the points that I give you credit for. You have an 8-point plan at the end of the book about what can be done. But my question was, is there any light at the end of the tunnel?
Militarily, no. Mm-hmm. No, there is no light at the end of the tunnel. And I personally don't think that whatever troop surges or whatever General Petraeus is asking for, a sustained commitment for more troops, more Predator drone attacks, is going to work. No, they won't. We have crossed zero when it comes to Pakistan and Afghanistan. We are, everything that we do now only adds to our involvement, makes it worse. It enrages the population of the country, breaks international laws, defies ethics, et cetera, all ad nauseum at
this point. You did answer my question.
Is that an answer for you? Okay.
Liz, your turn.
Well, I think the problem really is between India and Pakistan. You have a phenomenal ally for Afghanistan in India already. They are already doing it. They're the largest donor to Afghanistan right now to help try and rebuild civil society, while Pakistan is blowing up embassies in Afghanistan because they want to get the Indians out. So you can see that that is the key right now, that the Obama administration, if they actually put their attention on that issue, they could begin to change the dynamic of the region. They've got to break this insanity between Pakistan's attitude towards India and India's responses towards Pakistan.
We believe that that can be done by removing it from the issue of religion.
Mm-hmm.
Removing the issue of religion, of Islam versus Hinduism, the whole round, even the Western attitudes towards it. Remove it from that. We have one of the things that we proposed is this planning session for the Jirgas to be held in north of Dublin. The Irish have a very, very long history of colonial rule and relationship with Britain. They know the legacy of it. They know it very well. And they almost have the franchise down in terms of helping other countries.
The first colony.
Mm-hmm. Well, that seems very appropriate. I thought it was inappropriate when Bush and Blair met in Northern Ireland to talk about the occupation of Iraq. Mm-hmm. I had a little problem with the optics there. Liz, do you see any military solution here if we're there 10, 20, 30 years?
I think that the military approach that is being used is the problem. It is a heavy-handed, myopic, attack first, don't ask questions, anything I do is right attitude. That simply can't work anymore. And I think what we've shown in our book and our research is that the Afghan people have long been capable of developing their own democracy. And if they'd been left alone, first by the British and then by the Americans, they'd be well on their way to being a very stable, incredible country. In fact, Kabul was known as the Paris of the region before this crisis hit.
Yeah. In closing, let me ask you each to answer the question that was posed in the song at the beginning of this segment. Why are we there? Paul?
There are a lot of very complex, long-term geopolitical reasons for the occupation of Afghanistan. I would have to say that, you know, you'd have to look to the 19th century to see this whole idea of Western countries, Britain mainly, the Anglo-Saxon countries is what they refer to themselves as, actually. Anglo-Saxon foreign policy is controlling trade routes, oil routes in South Central Asia for the 21st century. Those pipelines that are going to go through there, China and India are becoming, if not already, the largest industrial manufacturers on the planet. They will be the dominant forces, economic forces, as we move into the 21st century.
Then in broad and simple terms, we know there are huge natural gas and some oil deposits in the region of the Caspian Sea. And this is a struggle over which way those resources will flow.
Mm-hmm.
Will they go east to China? Will they go west to Russia? Or will they go south into some area that is under the influence of the United States? Is that a fair,
yes, and
broad characterization?
Who's going to control the valve that turns that on and turns it off? That's what's going on right now.
And our position is that whatever happens, the Afghan people should be the ones to benefit from whatever kind of development the oil industry or any of these other resources are developed. And that really is the problem. The United States is approaching it just like the British Empire. It's basically saying we basically get to control the region in a relationship against Russia and in a relationship against China being the hegemon of the region. So this is 19th century colonial thinking. And I think there's a lot of Americans that need to realize that that's really what the problem here is. So when we're told over and over again in the narrative that we're bringing democracy to a people that already had it, that already were well on their own way, and that, it, in fact, it's the resources that are really underlying what Petraeus has already told us recently, that the United States will be in Afghanistan on bases after the troop withdrawal. We're seeing the fact that the resource issue is really a very much a big part of this, yeah, and has to be addressed.
Yeah. But unless those bases have the agreement and the consent of the population of Afghanistan, they're not going to be able to stay there. And that is something that is not even being considered as far as we know.
Mm-hmm. Liz, Paul, thank you very much. It's great to meet you in person, and I have deep respect for the work you're doing. I want to recommend the book Crossing Zero to every one of my listeners, and I hope you will pick it up and read it, because there's great history, context, and analysis there. And as we said toward the end of the book, some very constructive ideas about what the U.S. and the international community can do to help extricate us from this serious quagmire that we're bogged down in. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. Is Bradley Manning the Daniel Ellsberg of our time? And is he being persecuted by Barack Obama's administration? Given the Gitmo treatment in the brig at Quantico? I knew what I know now. That's a phrase sung by Rod Stewart there when he was with Faces back in the 70s. He was on CNN yakking with Piers Morgan last night, and I flipped the channel. I don't think Rod Stewart has anything more to say that I care about. But I wanted to use that song because Bradley Manning used that phrase in an email chat exchange that was published today on a very important blog that I want you to know about. Greg Mitchell has been, for the last 17 weeks, doing daily blog at thenation.com, entitled The WikiLeaks News and Views Blog, and it's a very good way to keep tabs on the Bradley Manning story, the WikiLeaks cases, and I really commend The Nation for deploying Greg to this beat and really keeping the story fresh at all times. Greg Mitchell, thank you for joining us today on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Oh, happy to be here.
So tell me how this started, because you've been working on this for 17 weeks. You keep tabs of it, and it's kind of a reminder of the way the ABC Nightline show began with the hostage count up during the Iran hostage case back in the 1970s.
Yeah, I actually tweeted a couple months ago that it was at that point, I don't know, day 61 of Greg Mitchell held hostage, and now we're up to 124. So, it didn't happen. I mean, it happened accidentally. I have a long career. I've written about 10 books. I've been editor and publisher of magazine and other magazines, and I was hired at The Nation last April to write a daily blog on the media called Media Fix, and I was doing that every day. Until and I'd covered, you know, WikiLeaks, the WikiLeaks releases of last year, just in the course of doing that. But then when the Cablegate release came at around Thanksgiving last year, I did a live blog on the first day because there was so much coming out and so many interesting things. And then, you know, continued the second day and a third day, and you know, it was so popular. And the unlike the earlier WikiLeaks releases, these this release, as we all know, came out over time and over months, still happening. So it was unlike the earlier releases, which were all kind of dumped on one day or one week. So I just sort of kept going. It was massively popular around the globe. No one else was really doing it. Some people did it for a while and then quit. And I just kept going. It really became the only, you know, frequently updated daily blog. And, you know, the hits kept coming, both in terms of the content of the cables, but also the attacks on Julian Assange and then his legal case and then Bradley Manning's conditions of confinement.
Mm-hmm.
Quantico then has gotten a lot of publicity the last couple of months. Meanwhile, the cables helped spark the revolt in Tunisia, which spread to Egypt and Yemen and Libya. And then there was more calls for, you know, the execution of Assange and or Manning. So it's just continued on and on. And I, in the course of this, I've also written two books, one called The Age of WikiLeaks, which came out a couple months ago, and then one that just came out last week called The Bradley Manning, Truth and Consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And so
let's pause
I've
for a second.
Continued on this area. Not really. It wasn't really my intention.
Let's pause for a second and tell people how to get your books, because your book is really the only profile biography of Bradley Manning that I'm aware of.
Right. Well, it's available as an e-book and every electronic thing you can think of for iPad and phones and PCs and everything else at Amazon. And it's available in print at blurb.com, blurb.com, so that you can get it both in print or as an e-edition.
Great. So let's start with some breaking news today. You and I are speaking on the last day of March. And there appears to be a case where the WikiLeaks revelations have caused the death of a Pakistani.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Well, it's been said going back to last year with the big leaks on Iraq and then Afghanistan, and then certainly since the release of the cables in November, you know, people have said, well, you know, Julian Assange has blood in his hands, or this is going to cause the death of innocent people, and so on and so forth. And it's often been said that actually in the whole past year, there is not a single documented case of anyone mentioned in the releases being harmed, being killed, or whatever. And, you know, and even the Pentagon at different times has admitted it. They've warned some people who may have been named informers, you know, low-level operatives and so forth,
mm-hmm.
Warned that this could happen, but there hasn't been a single documented case. Now today, we learn that there was a kind of very complicated Muslim leader in Pakistan who I guess is sympathetic to the Taliban, but also a cable was released in India last week, which revealed that he had also approached the U.S. about maybe working out a deal with the Taliban, which I guess was a no-no.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's been attacked twice in the last few days. You know, today there was a suicide bombing that killed, I think the toll is up to 12 now. Not him. He's mm-hmm. escaped both bombings. But apparently at least 12 people or more have died in these attacks. So some people are saying that this is the first case of where someone named in a WikiLeaks a document has, you know, has caused, you know, has led to some deaths. Although, you know, in this case it's completely different. This guy's a, you know, a Muslim leader, you know, power broker. It's not the kind of informer or, you know, low-level operative or assistant to, you know, people have worried about was going to get outed by one of these cables.
And Greg, it's not clear that he was targeted directly as a result of the
yeah.
WikiLeaks revelations.
Yeah, they're just saying, well, this came out a week ago, and there's been two rather serious attacks on him since then. So people are sort of making that connection. You know, who knows?
Mm-hmm. So, and prior to this, as you referenced, even Secretary of Defense Robert Gates has publicly acknowledged that there have been no real compromises of U.S. national security.
Right.
And I believe, Harvard yesterday, Dan Ellsberg repeated statements that he's made, which are to the effect that in most cases, the secrecy is used to prevent embarrassment and political scorekeeping or political hits and losses. And, you know, I think that is underscored, at least to date, by the history of the documents and information revealed, that it's mostly been embarrassing, not something that really caused any serious breach of U.S. national security.
Right. Well, you know, Gates has said that on numerous occasions, and sometimes he backs away from it. But he of all the people, he's been the most out front in sort of saying, look, this is embarrassing, this is troubling, we have to, you know, assure foreign leaders that we'll keep things more secret in the future. But there hasn't been a really serious setback. Now, we have seen how this has affected other countries. I mean, there hasn't been such a significant impact in the U.S., but one country after another, Indonesia, Mexico, India and Pakistan, Kenya, and then, of course, the more famous cases of Indonesia and Egypt and Yemen and Libya and so on, that has had a profound effect in many of these countries. So, and in many cases, a positive effect. And I think the point Ellsberg was making was that the secrets are kept, you know, not from foreign powers or in a Cold War sense or anything like that, but it's keeping secrets from our own people, that the American public. And this is certainly what Bradley Manning had insisted over and over in the chat logs you mentioned, where he talked about the motivation being that people deserve to know about what their country was doing in Iraq and Afghanistan and around the world, and that it was wrong to keep a lot of these sort of nasty secrets from the American public.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, Nancy Grace has not been appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court yet, but she epitomizes the rush to judgment that occurs in American media today. And I think it's fair to say that the corporate media, including the leading newspapers, tilt in favor of the government. And whenever they describe Bradley Manning, they assume that he's guilty. Right. And that he deserves the kind of very harsh treatment that we know that he's receiving at the brig at Quantico. Let's start with the media here, Greg, because we really have lost that presumption of innocence. And in the so-called war on terror, we've seen the media rush to judgment in the case of Jose Padilla, in some of these cases where paid FBI informants act as provocateurs and get people to do things that they weren't planning to do, and then they're entrapped and tried and convicted. And so I think it's very important to note that Bradley Manning is a suspect. And to date, what charges have been leveled against him, Greg?
Well, certainly serious charges have been leveled against him, you know, leaking classified material. They even have used the phrase leaking to the enemy. Mm-hmm. Which carries the death penalty, potentially, without defining who the enemy was, which was very interesting. Is it the foreign terrorists? Is it the media? Is it Julian Assange? Maybe WikiLeaks itself is the enemy. I don't know. But, the charges are serious. They've been leveled, but it's just the procedures have dragged on now. He's been in near solitary confinement for 9 months now. And there's very little sense that his trial or court martial is going to happen anytime soon.
Is it even scheduled at this point?
No, it's not. His attorney says some progress may be made in May or June. Some progress, but the two issues, of course, is he presumed? He has to be presumed innocent, and of course, there certainly seems to be some evidence against him. And the government may, in fact, or the military may have seized his computer and maybe totally incriminating stuff on his computers and so forth. But where that also comes into play is how he's being treated. And does someone who has not been convicted of anything deserve to be incarcerated under these conditions where he's in what some people call solitary or near solitary and maximum confinement? There's no question that he's confined for 23 hours a day in a small cell.
Mm-hmm. In California prisons, we call it the SHU, the Secured Housing Unit.
Yeah.
And these protocols are pretty similar. It's almost total isolation, no more than an hour a day outside the cell, no contact with other human beings,
right,
even with guards. And in Manning's case, they really ratcheted up the treatment in recent months, and they're pretty fuzzy about the reasons. They claim that they're all justifiable, but they essentially have him on a suicide watch, and they take away almost all of his clothing. I guess they've finally given him the kind of smock with that big gap in the back that people are familiar with when you go into the hospital. But, you know, it really begs a lot of important questions when you look carefully at the way he's being handled.
Well, you know, that's all true, and there was very little interest or outcry about this. I think one of the values in my book about Manning is that it really picks up his story, you know, to the point where most people, if they know about him, have learned about him in very recent weeks, if then. And so the book kind of traces what happened to him all of last year up to December when the first outcries really started to be heard, you know, from bloggers and political activists and so forth about his treatment. And, you know, that continued for 3 months, and it really wasn't until 2 weeks ago here in March that, and it took Hillary Clinton's chief spokesman at the State Department, P.J. Crowley,
right,
who very offhandedly in a discussion in a class at MIT had the nerve to say that he, too, believed that the treatment of Manning in prison was horrible and terrible and counterproductive. Someone in that class, a BBC reporter, blogged it. Crowley then stood by it, and within a day or two, he was basically fired or resigned.
Right. And I know P.J. Crowley. I've talked to him many times. He was at the Center for American Progress during the Bush administration,
mm-hmm.
and he's a straight shooter.
Yeah.
He's a man with, I believe, 28 years of service in the military. And so he was, there were times I took exception to the statements he was making as the mouthpiece for Hillary Clinton, but that's his job.
Well, he was very, very tough on WikiLeaks. In fact, he was on Twitter. He was very critical of WikiLeaks and Assange and so forth. So he's no WikiLeaks lover.
Right.
But it took his statement and dismissal to finally get the attention of the media. And lo and behold, within a few days, almost every major newspaper, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, San Francisco Chronicle, and others, finally ran their first editorials, protesting Manning's treatment. So basically, people complaining about it for 3 months got absolutely nowhere. But then Crowley's exit prompted the media to finally say, hey, yeah, you know, this treatment is more like Gitmo than what we usually see in the U.S.
And the president himself has, I think, answered one question publicly about it, and basically just says that he believes that it's being handled appropriately.
Yeah, well, he was asked at a press conference by Jake Tapper what he thought about it, and he said he had gone out of his way to ask the military about it, and they told him that everything was fine, that this was normal treatment. And of course, this prompted people to say, you're asking the military if they're doing anything wrong. Of course, they're going to say they're not. So it wasn't exactly a convincing response.
Yeah. And Greg, just in the last few days, the Frontline investigative series at PBS broadcast a package, and I didn't see it, but I saw a clip of it. And you put out some comments that were also published on the Huffington Post. And they entitled their piece, Private Life of Bradley Manning. Tell us what you thought of the work that Frontline did in this case.
Well, I think they're working on a longer piece, and I think what happened was they got what they thought was a scoop that they wanted to get out as soon as possible. So they just did a 10-minute segment, and it basically revolved around a 911 call where Manning was, before he joined the Army, he had an altercation with his mother and father. They called 911, and it settled down right away, and he was later kicked out of the house, no charges were brought, and so forth. But it was a sensationalistic, thing, and it sort of colored their whole episode, where it was called The Private Life of Private Manning. And, looked into his growing up, and a lot of it focused around, troubles he had, or isolation he had, or the fact he was gay, and it suggested that the reason he ended up getting involved with this leak, if indeed he did, was purely because of his personal life, turmoil in his personal life. There was no mention of any long-standing political beliefs he had, or anything he might have seen in Iraq, or anything like that. So And then it closed by simply saying, you know, Bradley Manning is currently in the brig at Quantico without any mention of the controversy over the conditions. So I felt, you know, I wrote a piece for Huffington Post before it came out just saying I thought this was just a sensationalist, sensationalist thing. And then actually today I wrote another piece at Huffington Post, which is drawn from my book, and my new book on Manning is I reprint much of these famous chat logs where Manning allegedly is talking about what motivated him and how he did this leak, if indeed he did, and of course in there he talks a great deal about why he did this and the people need to see the truth and the probable abuses he saw in Iraq and so on and so forth. So I print that in my book. It hasn't appeared in print to that extent before. And so there's my piece at Huffington Post excerpts from some of that. So that was basically my complaint, was that it sort of did it. It was an injustice, sort of almost like a hit piece on Bradley Manning, making it seem like he was just kind of a wacko, had some romantic problems or something, and so he decided to do this massive leak.
Well, and let me just read a couple of the excerpts here that you have published, and I'll link to it in the show file so people can go to Huffington Post and read it verbatim. And God knows what happens now. Hopefully worldwide discussion, debates, and reforms. If not, then we're doomed as a species. I want people to see the truth, regardless of who they are, because without information, you can't make informed decisions as a public. If I knew then what I know now, kind of thing, as I referenced as we opened this segment. I don't believe in good guys versus bad guys anymore, only a plethora of states acting in self-interest. I was watching 15 detainees taken by the Iraqi federal police for printing anti-Iraqi literature. And he goes on to say that he had a translator explain it to him. And when I found out it was a benign political critique titled "Where Did the Money Go?" and following the corruption trail with the prime minister's cabinet, I took that information and ran to the officer to explain what was going on. He didn't want to hear any of it. He told me to shut up and explain how we could assist the Iraqi federal police in finding more detainees. So, these are issues that are substantive, that don't.
Well, one of the most amazing things is that the earlier people are, familiar with Cablegate now from the last few months, but they forget that all the Iraq and Afghanistan documents that he or someone released last summer, and the thing you just read refers to what was made headlines for one day. When it was leaked, which is that basically the U.S. servicemen were ordered to sort of stand by and stand away while allowing Iraqis to take detainees away from them, knowing they would be tortured. There wasn't like any question about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically saying, okay, we have these detainees and we don't want to torture them, but we'll turn them over to the Iraqis and we know they will. And thanks to Bradley Manning, if indeed he is guilty, this was a one-day giant story in the media and incredibly incriminating of our military. And then it faded.
Mm-hmm.
And there were so many scoops, so many things, troubling things that came out in these Iraq and Afghanistan war logs that got attention for a while, and then it was time to turn the page. So there's a direct link between what you just read with what Manning himself witnessed, and then if he's guilty, he then, within a matter of a few weeks of witnessing that, decided to start leaking, and so that's where we are today, but it's based on very real abuses.
Greg, I also want to encourage listeners to read the chapter that you've published for free from the new book, or go ahead and buy the whole book, spring for it.
It's only $3.99 as an ebook, and I think $9.95 as print. So it's
good
buy.
That's a bargain, yeah. But the chapter that I read helped me understand the somewhat bizarre exchange that I saw with Brian Manning, Bradley's father, on the PBS NewsHour, and I think it's now about 2 weeks ago. And he had gone public complaining about the enforced nudity, that Bradley was having to give up all of his garments and sleep in the nude. And that occurred, for about 2 to 3 weeks?
Yeah, couple weeks at least. So that we know of. It's kind of been a blackout the last couple weeks, but it did go on for at least a couple weeks.
So Brian Manning was objecting to that specific aspect of Bradley's treatment, but he then volunteered that Bradley had never complained about anything else to him regarding the isolation, the 23 hours alone every day.
Right.
And I found that to be questionable, or at least it suggested a huge disconnect. And you gave us the history in this chapter that this was a father and son who didn't get along terribly well, and things got worse when Bradley Manning came out as a gay man.
Right. Well, that's you know, the front line brought out the episode that came out this week did go in a little more into it, but brought up more, I guess, more negative things about the father. But my problem with that is they made it too much like Manning had daddy issues, you know, and that somehow his leak was tied to his all this personal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I just question that a great deal. There's no question he had a difficult childhood with his father, and but you know, the thing is that you know, when he went into the military, you know, he was in the military for 3 years. He was an intelligence analyst. He was given access to this material. He was seen as trusted enough. You know, and they seem to want to paint him as this mentally disturbed, emotionally disturbed person. But somehow he was given access to the top secrets, obviously. And, you know, right up to the, if he hadn't been involved in this chat log with this, you know, convicted hacker, Adrian Lamo, he probably would still be active in the military now and still have access to those secrets. So, you know, it's a very odd story, and it's very odd how he came to be busted. It's just a very strange story from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. And I want to encourage people to follow your blog at thenation.com. And again, I thank you and The Nation for this important service. Before you go, though, Greg, I've got to get your comment on this story that was published by Politico today, that President Obama has received an award for transparency, but it was delivered in secret. Now this is just frickin' bizarre, because I have followed the cases of other whistleblowers, not just Private Manning, and I will state flatly that this president is more aggressive in following up on whistleblowers, investigating and convicting them, than
right.
George W. Bush was, and this to me is like a second Nobel Prize. Because they told him they wanted to give him this award, and so they held a closed, undisclosed meeting at the White House this past Monday, and he met with the leaders of OMB Watch, the National Security Archive, POGO, the Project on Government Oversight, Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, and OpenTheGovernment.org, without disclosing the meeting on his public schedule or letting photographers or print reporters into the room. Now, I challenged these oversight groups in giving this award. One of them apparently muttered afterward that it was kind of aspirational, like the Nobel Prize. But this is embarrassing. And even the White House was embarrassed at the prospect of the president receiving this award. So they kept the Transparency Award secret.
Well, I'm not sure I can add to what you've said so eloquently, except, you know, traditionally everyone loves whistleblowers until you're kind of stuck with dealing with them and dealing with their revelations, and suddenly you become suspicious of whistleblowers and don't like the idea. So it's completely normal. Same way with transparency in terms of releasing documents. You believe in releasing stuff. You're opposed when you're the other administration is withholding things, but once you're the one who might suffer because of release of things, suddenly you want to keep everything close to the vest. So it's all too predictable, I suppose.
Well, and for me, it's infuriating, Greg, because the central point for me is that Obama has orchestrated a very effective cover-up for the wrongdoing that occurred under Bush. And we have Bush and Rumsfeld trotting around the country promoting books in which they admit to crimes. And yet we're looking forward, not backward,
right,
on high crimes and things that I consider to be serious constitutional violations. But, oh, are we going to throw the book at Bradley Manning?
Well, it's, you know, the other contradiction is the media that, the U.S. media, which often denounces WikiLeaks and Assange, certainly Manning, but yet takes advantage of their scoops for hundreds of days of scoops that they've provided and happily put on their front page, and yet then turn around and knock the people who provide the scoops and claim that they're, some of them violate national security. And so it seems like they want to take advantage of the leak, but then still go after the leakers. So that's also a big problem.
Well, and you have a recent post on your blog that, Obama is leaking like mad to the media on Libya,
right?
Of course, continues to persecute Bradley Manning.
Yeah, well, when you want your message out or you want it spun in a certain way, you leak to reporters, even though they're nationally classified. Just in the last two or three days, they've leaked the fact the CIA is already in Libya. They've leaked that Obama has already gone for approval to
a presidential finding.
Right, presidential mm-hmm. finding to go much further on Libya than supply the rebels with arms and so forth. And two or three other things all have come out, sort of leaked by the administration, which most people would say highly classified, highly potentially dangerous kind of stuff to get out there. But yet they turn around and complain about other secrets that are leaked that are much less dangerous than what they're leaking themselves.
Yeah. Well, Greg Mitchell, thank you for joining us today. And again, thanks for your work blogging about WikiLeaks and Manning and the related issues. And we'll be checking in with you frequently because this story is not going away.
All right. Well, thanks for chatting.
All right. Greg Mitchell, thenation.com. Thanks for listening to this episode, a leaky episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. I'd love your comments. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.